please welcome Horatio Clare and Julia Wheeler.
Have a seat. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Stanford Travel Writers Festival. Delighted to see you here this lunchtime. My name is Julia Wheeler, and I'm also delighted to be here to talk with the winner of the Stanford Dolman Travel Writers of the Year Prize, Horatio Clare. And he's going to be talking about his magical book, Hold It Up, Down to the Sea in Ships. And we may also get time to talk about one of his latest as well, Orison for a Curlew. The first book takes us on two journeys. The first one from Felixstowe to Los Angeles and then Antwerp to Montreal, courtesy of two different ships and the company of their crews. It's a voyage of discovery on a number of levels, and the writing is absolutely wonderful, magical, lyrical, and all of those things. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Horatio Clare.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you. Now, one of the wonderful things about this book is that it takes us into a world that we are fully reliant on for the way that we live, but actually know very little about.
Yes, that's more or less how it occurred to me. So most of what's in this hall, apart from the human bodies, came here on a container ship. And in order for it to arrive, a very small crew of men, probably about 13, took their lives to sea for up to 9 months on a gigantic container ship, which almost certainly came here from China the long way round. And so every single item that you see in this room, more or less, depends on very small crews of men far from home and family. And there was a time when we would have been most acquainted with them. The great port of London was rammed with ships. But with the invention of the container in the 1960s, all that moved away from us. Container ports require motorways, arterial roads, lots of space. And so that entire universe now exists behind very high wire, and it's out of sight and mind. And I was living in Verona, and walking around the Adige, which is the river there, one dark night, and I'd just been reading Moby Dick, and I thought my next book suddenly became clear to me. You all know the first line of Moby Dick, call me Ishmael. Well, the second line is, when I get my humours get the upper hand of me, and it's dank November in my soul, and I have difficulty not joining every funeral cortege that passes and knocking strangers' hats off in the street, I count it high time to go to sea. So I went back to my flat and I emailed Maersk, who are a gigantic Danish container organization. And they have 18% of world trade, of global container trade. And they produce as much carbon dioxide as does the nation of Denmark. And I sent them an email saying, how would you like a writer in residence? They're a $24 billion company. So they have very little to fear from writers. And they, surprisingly to me, emailed straight back and said, yes, we'll take you. Where do you want to go? And what do you want to write about? And so I studied their schedules, and I chose two voyages, one from Felixstowe, the long way round, to Los Angeles, which is 2 months. And that's almost as long as you can be at sea, because ships are so fast. And they're only in port for a night at most, really. And then another across the North Atlantic in the middle of winter, and that was from Antwerp to Montreal. And that's how it came about.
So that was your motivation. The crews that you met on board these two ships, what were their motivations for going to sea in the first place? Well, the sailors.
The thing about the sea is that there are only three powers out there, and it's what the captain decides to do, what the ship can handle, and what the weather does. But what's extraordinary is that for all this to work, for our universe to work, those things have to coalesce into a supply chain which is as predictable as a conveyor belt. So in other words, the captain has 2 months to get the ship from here to Los Angeles, and he needs to arrive there at 2:30 in the afternoon precisely, otherwise they incur huge fines. Of course, with the sea being what it is and with ships being what they are, it's a really old-fashioned business in many ways. And the first shock of going aboard a ship is that there's still racial pyramids. So the ones that I joined were both owned by the Danes. The officers were white Europeans. Dutch and Danish captains and chief engineers and first mates and chief second mates. And then you go down to Eastern Europeans and Indians at the sort of junior officer level. And then the actual wiping and oiling, and you start as a wiper or oiler, was all done by Filipino seafarers. And if you break down the world container trade, it's Filipinos, Chinese, and Indonesians who make the whole thing work. And they can be paid as little as $900 a month, and they sign on for 9 months at a time, and they look for extensions to their contracts to 13 months, and they live the most extraordinary life. It's a cross, if you can imagine it, between a Premier Inn and a kind of mechanical hell. So you each have a cabin. That's the one thing that's changed. You eat together on watches. Your hours of work aren't regulated. Your hours of rest are regulated. It's the only industry that's regulated by hours of rest. Otherwise, they would work all the hours that God sends and more. Half of them are engaged in making the ship run from the deck upwards. So there's lots of cleaning, lot of oiling, a lot of securing cargo, a lot of washing. And the other half are making the engine run. And the engine is phenomenal. If you went out into the highest part of Olympia and looked up, that's a ship's engine room. And it's like a giant cathedral of steel with this howling machine in the middle of it, which never sleeps. And they burn through 7,000 and upwards dollars worth of diesel a day, depending on the ship, up to $70,000 worth, depending on the speed and the weather conditions. And this great machine is a puzzle that's never finished. And it throws out extraordinary volumes of noise. So even with ear defenders in, you're still communicating by screams and lip reading. It throws out about 40 degrees of heat by itself. So if you can imagine that, plus 100% humidity in Tanjung Pelepas or in Malaysia or in Vietnam. And then, of course, it's all rocking and swaying. So when I asked a young engineer, why do you do this? He said, I love it. The engine is a puzzle that's never finished. I actually love the engine room. But it's an extraordinary business for that reason. And they said, you know, imagine screwing a nut onto a bolt. Not so difficult. Imagine screwing a nut onto a bolt in 40 degrees of heat after 3 days of no sleep. Because, of course, in a storm, the whole thing rocks and riddles. And there is no sleep. And the cook can't cook. So all you eat is cheese, actually. And then try and screw a nut onto a bolt. Not so easy. And then, on top of that, you have to keep a cheerful demeanor. Because nobody can survive on a ship unless they're able to enforce some kind of morale within them. And for a writer, this is what became so interesting to me, because it became a story about men and how they did it. And they are the most extraordinary men. And my first captain, I don't think he'd ever sailed with a bad sailor, because he would have thrown him off the ship. He'd have been off at the first port. So you have to have this combination of inner strength, optimism, and tremendous self-reliance. Crews are temporary things. You know, at the end of the voyage, everybody disperses to another ship. So it's a question of coming together, making it work, and then spreading out again across the world. As to who they are, it depends on the race. I mean, my Danish captains, Maersk don't make many captains under the age of 50, because you need that experience. You can't fake it or inculcate it. It actually has to be lived. And when Maersk decided to dry out their ships, in other words, just to cancel all the alcohol which had hitherto propelled the trade, they had to send a lot of their captains to rehab because they couldn't lose them. So these men came back and they did what they do. And you can smoke, so they were sort of chain smoking, Marlboro Red figures. And then lower down, they're very young men, Filipinos often, and Indians and Eastern Europeans on my ships anyway, who had dreamed this young man's dream of going to sea. And in the Philippines, it's a really good job in that the rate of pay is high. The difference, though, is that an Indian and a Filipino engineer in the same engine room doing the same job will be paid different rates of money. The Filipino will be on a much, much lower rate because their union is simply not strong enough. But the thing about the sea is that it's an example of what happens when a world is unobserved, unregulated by the unions, unstudied by journalists. So it's a free-for-all, in fact. And the thing that I had to remember with this book was that I was seeing the absolute best of it. And I did see miracles, both natural, mechanical, and human, but I was looking at the top end of the industry. At the bottom end, it's a black hole. And the people thrown overboard, the murders at sea, the rapes, the absolute appalling darkness of the lower end of the shipping industry is almost unexplored.
You touched there on the danger side of things, and let's talk a little bit about the order. I mean, one of the things that struck me...
It's not me.
Is it me? No. Somebody. One of the things that struck me was that actually that you had... Maersk were very open to you, but actually they made you get off the ship, didn't they? Because you were not allowed... you were not insured to go through pirate-infested waters.
I had to lie to them a couple of times. So a ship offers its passengers something called deviation insurance, which is if I was sick or sufficiently ill to require being thrown off the ship, they wanted me to bear the cost or someone of having to reroute this multi-million dollar vessel. And so I sort of fudged that with a very cheap travel insurance. I couldn't fudge the pirate area. I was really quite looking forward to going across the Red Sea, because at last I would have been useful. They could actually use another pair of eyes. And in all other senses, I was spectacularly useless. But I offered them my own ransom in my savings, and they said no, they weren't taking that. So they made me get off in Suez, and they drew a big red line around the Indian Ocean and said no passengers, and they let me get back on in Malaysia. And when I got back on, I said, so did you see anything? And the captain said, no, nothing happened. And then I asked the crew, did you see anything? They said, yeah, we heard it, we saw it. And it was very busy time for pirate attacks during that period, which is 2011-12. Maersk had just stopped short at that point of allowing armed guards onto the ships. As soon as they did, the pirate attacks decreased dramatically, as they were bound to do.
Give us an idea of some of the characters that you met, perhaps on board the first ship, because I do get the impression that that was your favourite ship, and the relationship between them.
Well, they say you never forget your first voyage, and my captain could name and date his. It's an extraordinary experience, because you approach through the docks at Felixstowe, and there's this monstrous thing. And she was only the third biggest kind of ship that there is, so not even the most gigantic. And all of your crew, there are so few of you, are all corralled into this little mess, this deck house, the back end of the ship. So your experience is at once of tremendous intimacy and also great isolation, because as soon as you leave the deck house, you're on this monstrous thing, and it's full of containers, and you don't know what's in them. So the crew give their lives to carrying boxes. They only are told what's in the dangerous containers that will catch fire and what's in the cold ones that need to be kept cold. So my cabin mate, one door down, Nestor, the electrician, his job as we crossed the North Atlantic through Force 9 gales was to climb a ladder every 4 hours, three stories up, and I watched him do it in horizontal sleet with the deck all iced to check that the frozen shrimp was still frozen. And on the way back, he was going to do the same thing with lobsters, and he was going to check that these lobsters, which will be sold inevitably in the south of France and had come from Halifax, were still breathing. And it seemed loopy and insane. So the kind of man he was a man of tremendous good humor. The captain was remarkable. They are very strong. They're very lonely. By naval tradition, the British Navy, the captain always eats alone. In our ship, the captain and the crew ate together, or the captain and the officers ate together. But for whatever reason, the captain, whenever there was a lull in conversation, would talk to himself in Danish, in whispers. So you'd sort of sit there crunching through carrots, and the captain would be going, and then he would look up and I would say, Captain, he'd say, yes, Claire, you know, not a foolish question from this alien that he was carrying, and I always had another question. He was rather wonderful, but the moment that I will never forget was the barbecue, where it was always a matter of responsibility of the captain that there must be something to boost morale on these ships. And our morale boosting exercise was a barbecue that took place in the mid-Pacific. The ships surging along 20 knots. There's no land in a week in either direction. North of us, the Aleutian Islands, south of us, Hawaii. And they get out fairy lights, which they string between the containers. And we all grill our own piece of squid and our own steak, because obviously we're all alpha males. And then we ate them to the accompaniment of sort of lover's rock through a Filipino jukebox. And there was an absolute melancholy about it as you saw these men thinking about barbecues where there'd been women, children, sun and beer. All of the things which they have cut themselves off more or less for their professional lives. It's a different deal, you know, as a captain. They can do 6 months at sea or less and they're paid very well. But as a junior officer or a rating, as it were, it's a life sentence. And they sacrifice themselves for their families. So for me, it was an exercise in extraordinary admiration. I couldn't believe the honour of the company in which I travelled.
The one female member of the crew was the cook on the second ship. And you say that the cook is actually the conduit, often on any ship, between the captain and the crew, so they're absolutely vital in that communication.
Yes, the cook is the one person to whom the captain speaks as an equal, because the cook controls an entirely separate empire the captain doesn't understand. And the galley is the one place where you have a sort of reminiscence of home. So it's the one place where you find people dropping their demeanour and just being themselves. And of course, when I said I was going to sea, my friends all said, oh, it'll be rum, sodomy and the lash. But of course, there's no rum. A sodomy I can't speak for, there was no lash at all, and the whole idea of macho men is nonsense. I mean, in order to survive for that long in this tin box, you've got to be very sensitive. So they were tremendously gentle, tremendously kind, always polite. The language of the sea is English, so it was good morning, good evening, good watch, good night, good appetite, and there was this great sort of kindness. And there were moments of tremendous humour, but the worrying thing for a captain is what the crew, what they are thinking and doing. And on my second ship, there was a definite segregation between us and them. And us happened to be all white, and they happened to be all Filipino. And the link was the cook. So everything went through the galley, and she was a lady called Annabelle, tough as boots, a wonderful woman, and the first my captain, the first woman my captain had sailed with in his entire career, so over 20 years at sea. And when we had these appalling storms, he couldn't decide whether to blame the writer or the cook. And they came down actually on me. But there was that conduit and that link. And it was astonishing getting to Montreal finally. And you look forward to arriving at land so much. And when you get there, you say, right, what are we doing? And we were going to run. So there, Montreal is a container park, motorways in the snow, and then a supermarket where you go around with trolleys and you load and load and load with vegetables and then run back to the ship, cook it as fast as possible, get it on the captain's table, and then they're gone again. And that's what's changed. It was a very melancholy experience in that talking to anybody who'd been on ships for any length of time, they talked about what fun it used to be. You were in port for weeks, loading and unloading by hand, effectively, with derricks and cranes. A really complicated business. And you'd be right in the middle of Antwerp, and you were a young man with cash. So all those girl in every port jokes were true once upon a time. But now, of course, the container port is nowhere near the city. You can't get there except on a taxi ride that would wipe out your wage. And there's nothing to see, and you've got no time to see it. So they see a very strange parallel world. There are one or two ports, like Hong Kong and Algeciras, where that's not true, and you can still have fun, but it's 4 in the morning till 6 in the morning kind of fun, and then back on board, and then off again. And obviously, you've all come as travellers to this show, and some companies do take paying guests. Maersk doesn't, but it is something I would absolutely recommend. I mean, what I haven't talked about is the miracle and the wonder and the beauty of it, which is intense. We think of the world as very small, and part of the show, the sort of ethos is that you can go anywhere, but of course you can't. I mean, you can't go to the vast majority of it, which is the great oceans, except on cruises or tiny little yachts. On the other hand, they are all crisscrossed all the time by these extraordinary ships, which keep us all going. And some companies, CMA, CMG does it, and others, you can just Google travel by container ship, and there are some very good London firms that do it. It's the most extraordinary experience, because one, there's nature like you've never seen it before. I mean, out in the middle of the Pacific, the clearest air I've ever seen, the birds, the sea life, and you see it all the time. There's this astonishing sense of scale and beauty and wonder. And we were talking earlier about how on a Serengeti plain or in Busanga, you'll suddenly feel small and miraculous for it. Well, the sense of scale of the mid-ocean is extraordinary, and my captain, who was resolutely not sentimental, none of them are, although some of them are romantic, he did say, when you get home, Claire, they will ask you what it was like, and you will tell them, and they will think of sunsets and sunrises, but they will never understand, no matter how much you tell them, how vast the oceans are. And that was the most reassuring and amazing thing about it, is that this is still a gigantic planet. And if a company is confident enough to take paying guests, then you will be traveling unlike most seafarers. You'll probably have Wi-Fi. Most seafarers have no access to the internet or very limited access to the internet. So imagine going away from home for 9 months and being able to do nothing about it. That wouldn't be the experience of somebody traveling on a ship. The food is pretty workmanlike, because in the absence of alcohol or the opposite sex or much entertainment, food's really important, and the cooks tend to be pretty good. I mean, it's rich in the pleasures of fat and salt, but you can eat well too. And the experience of doing it is remarkable, and there are accounts. There's a very good one by Rose George called 90% of Everything, which is about the shipping business. But I would unhesitatingly recommend to any writers or readers among you, travel by container ship, because your life will be on hold on land. It won't really exist. You'll be able to exist in the company of a very few men, the great oceans, and whatever it is you're writing or reading.
Let's hear some of what you've written. So this, taking us from the vastness actually to a very busy seaway, perhaps you'd set it up for us.
Yes, so it's not on that map, unfortunately. There are several points on the voyage where the captain really earns his living. And there was one extraordinary one, which was the egress from Tanjung Pelepas into the Malacca Strait. And the Tanjung Pelepas is a swamp at the southern tip of Malaysia. And it was built in order to take some of the huge amount of trade that goes through Singapore. So when you leave Tanjung Pelepas at night, it's equivalent really to pulling out into the middle of the motorway blindfold in a ship. It's much longer than this building. By the time I'd walked around it, I'd have done a kilometre, 115,000 tons, and everybody's lives and other people's lives all riding on it. And this was just a normal evening as far as the captain was concerned, but a bit special for everybody else. And I noticed they all came out to watch him do it. So we assume that you just press the button and the ship follows its program course. That doesn't happen in certain parts of the world. It doesn't happen in ports. In fact, when they surveyed Hong Kong for safety, they came back that the inner harbor was unsurveyable, and it was a miracle there wasn't an accident there every day. And it's simply down to seamanship. So this is Tanjung Pelepas on a very hot night. Just after sunset, we leave the berth. The night is as black as the bottom of the sea, the air thick and languid. All three navigating officers are on the bridge, because this is a corner of the world in which you want as much practice as possible. The egress from TPP, which will take us out into the Singapore Strait, is akin to pulling out of a car park into a confluence of 2 8-lane motorways. The first channel is tight, leaving very little room to move. A ship is coming up towards us. Ships under navigation show red light on their port side and green on their starboard. Can you see his red? Naturally, in accord with the convention of the sea, we will pass port side to port side. Can you see his red? That is not the problem. Can you see his red, second mate? Shubd is staring through binoculars, so is Sorin, but though we can all see the green on his starboard side with the naked eye, there is no red showing. This means he is angling across our bows. This is bullshit, says the captain, suddenly pointing at the electronic chart. The screen has a triangle representing the approaching ship, neatly off our port bow, its course aligned in such a way that we could not possibly be blind to the red light on the port side unless the bulb has gone, not even worth considering. The two hulls converge through the darkness. The captain's instruments are lying to him. There is very little time. Starboard 10! Starboard 10! If we are where the automatic identification system says we are, this course will take us aground. Sign swears and jumps forward, pressing buttons on the radar console as the ship shows red light at last. The gyro, he shouts, the slave station is not adjusted. The electronic chart realigns. We are exactly where we should be, and the radar screen is a nightmare, spattered with heavy gold rain, every drop a ship at anchor or charging underway. One monster shoots across us, doing 20 knots, showing three lights. The confusion is doubled because the anchor vessels are all lit up, while the movers show only navigation lamps. All the captain's humming and muttering stop. Now he dances around the bridge, studying screens, spotting boys, and gruffly teaching Shubbed. You see, second mate, have they called you, second mate? Yes, they have. You see here. He keeps talking, explaining where he is heading, where the hazards are, on which side we will pass them. We look out for certain buoys and certain depths as we turn northeast into the strait. Now we will have some fun with the echo sounder. Look! He is navigating by paper chart, electronic chart, by light, depth, and buoys all at once. Singapore passes, strobing, towering, silent glitter to the north. To the south, the Indonesian shore is orange in the dark. Above the hum of the engine and the sigh of the air conditioning, there is the captain's teaching, radio static, and the voice of Straits Traffic Control, an alluring tone, both soft and clear. Could you do me a favor, second mate? Yes, captain. Call that girl and ask her if she would like to have a baby with the captain.
Wonderful. So there is a little bit of macho-ness and elements of chauvinism and sexism that everybody laughs along with, isn't there?
That was the laughter of breaking tension. I mean, the captain was very well married, and so was the second mate. But what we were watching was not just a lesson in how to navigate a ship, but also in how to teach. And that, I think, was what it was there needs to come a time when the class can all giggle like boys. And the captain was brilliant at that. Yeah.
So let's talk about the superstitions, because one of the things that that first captain does is hum a lot, but never whistles.
There was no whistling at sea. So in all this automated, extraordinary world, there are still superstitions. You never hurt a bird. In fact, Sorin, my second mate, knew a man who'd found a bird that was sick, and he'd thrown it overboard, having broken its neck. And the next day, this man lost his arm. And Sorin said, if he'd been anyone else, I wouldn't have believed him, but he was a Turk, and Turks don't lie. And of course, the guy had no arm. So nobody hurled any birds. There was no whistling, because that brings storms. There was no bare feet on the steel decks, and there was no turning your back on the sea. And these things were all observed on that voyage. On my next one, I got onto the ship, and the captain was walking up and down the bridge, whistling Leonard Cohen's famous blue raincoat. And I thought, we're for it. And I really felt it too. So yes, although it's not a sentimental business, it is quite romantic, and some of them are tattooed in the way that sailors were always tattooed. So you see anchors for crossing the Atlantic, and a friend of mine has just had his magnificent nipples tattooed with swallows, because you get a swallow for 5,000 miles at sea, but if you get two of them in the right place, should you die at sea, the swallows will carry your spirit home. And you get a gold dragon for a stop in a Chinese port, and sailing ships for crossing the date line. So there's a whole code, which I think is a very old code. They used to say that a leatherback sailor, you could read his whole life in his tattoos, and that still continues, at least for some of them.
We've talked a little bit about isolation. I wonder how you personally dealt with that, how well?
I liked it, but then I was there to ask questions, and I didn't have the relentless clocking on, clocking off. So what I did was shadow everybody's job, from the captain to the watchman, and that was the strangest one. So a ship is very well equipped with radar. You're in the middle of the Pacific. You haven't seen another vessel, not even on the edges of the screens, for a week, and there's another week to go, and you probably won't see another vessel for 4 or 5 days. It's the second mate's watch, so it's going from 8 o'clock till about 4 in the morning, and he's standing there, and he's in charge of the ship. He's got a watchman, and the watchman is a Filipino, and his job is to stand at the far end of the bridge in the darkness and stare forward to make sure the ship doesn't hit anything. And he'd do that for 4 hours. 4 hours. And I did it too, and it becomes a deeply psychedelic experience, and the attempt to stay awake is really quite hard work. And it becomes very meditative. I've never done yoga or meditation, except then. One felt that one was doing it. So yes, it's pretty strange. And in terms of the isolation, nobody asks what goes on behind the cabin doors. You're supposed to be strong with yourself, but that's your one private place. There's a lot of praying. The Filipinos are very Catholic, so there's that. And occasionally, when we were anchored in Suez, for example, there was karaoke. where the crew gathered together, and one of the very few rights that Filipino seafarers have negotiated through their union is the right to a karaoke machine. So fair pay, no, karaoke, yes. And they sang these wonderful keening love songs. And I'll never forget it because everybody had left their shoes outside the library door. And so there was just this great pile of shoes and then coming through the door, this kind of karaoke wailing. And the isolation is a strange thing. It's very much part of it. But that's infinitely preferable, of course, to being trapped on a boat for the 2-month duration of a voyage with somebody you don't like, or somebody who doesn't like you, or somebody whose family, your family, is entwined with in a negative way, which does happen. And when I was out there crossing the North Atlantic, there was a sudden darkness on the ship. Everybody, heads were down, and they looked miserable and scared. And I said, what is it? And they said, have you not heard about the Maersk Luz? Now, the Maersk Luz journeys from Western Australia, and she takes 2 months, slow steaming, to save diesel, to get to the eastern seaboard of South America. And in all that time, she's not touching land. And she's not doing it now. They've changed the route. I checked the other day, but that's what she was doing then. And obviously, something had gone very wrong on that voyage, because when she got to Argentina in the port of Buenos Aires, one seafarer stabbed 2 of his shipmates to death with a knife. Now, I only knew because it came through that day. I've searched the Buenos Aires newspapers. It doesn't matter how deeply you go into the internet or into archives, there is no record of that double murder. It doesn't exist because it effectively happened at sea, where effectively there is no law. And so that's the other side of it. And it's particularly complicated, I think, for Filipino and Chinese seafarers, because the Philippines, you know, it's quite a small world, and so you can get on board with the wrong person. So I was very lucky in that both my ships were happy ships. Is a real difference between a bad captain and a bad ship. A bad captain is a nightmare for the duration of a voyage. A bad ship is a nightmare in itself. And the stories they told were absolutely chilling about murders at sea, disappearances, cursed ships. There was one awful one involving Hunterston, a port in Scotland. And there are sea priests still in most great ports. And the Mission to Seafarers is one of the few organizations that seafarers trust and believe understand them. And they are quite busy with going aboard ships to perform services after bad things have happened in order to cleanse the spirit of the thing. Because the strange thing about these vessels is that they are sentient structures, or they feel that way, partly because the cargo bangs and howls and moans, and each ship is different, and my second ship was just impregnated with diesel, so you just breathe diesel for 3 weeks, that was all it was, and peculiarities of the doors and the drafts and the music, and they can all tell you stories of haunted ships.
And you talk actually about never forgetting the sounds of the Pembroke. Just comes through. Is that the big memory that you'll take with you?
Certainly, the big audio memory is the sounds of the Maersk Pembroke. So she was built for the South Pacific. She had open bridge wings, beautiful ship. And in her heyday, there are pictures of her outside Sydney Harbour Bridge, looking wonderful. And now she's plying backwards and forwards this loss-making route across the North Atlantic, following the route of the North Atlantic convoys, which is, of course, a mass graveyard. Underneath you, there are ships of every nationality which were sunk during the Second World War, and you're going over their iron carcasses and all their scattered cargo are deep beneath you. And on certain nights, we had a very stormy passage, you go out onto the bridge wing in rushing darkness, and it feels like everything is alive, and you think, my God, they used to do this, our ancestors used to do this, week in, week out, with U-boats out there ready to sink you, when every noise would have been an invitation to them. And what was so extraordinary about that story was that it wasn't voluntary. Because of the war, they were subject to compulsory work orders. So in other words, you'd get there, having survived, you'd be put straight back on the next one and sent back. And that lasted for 3 years, more or less, unless you were sunk. And also their status was the lowest of the low. So Lady Nancy Astor suggested that seafarers ought to wear yellow identification badges when in port, denoting the possibility that they carried venereal disease. You can imagine how they felt about that, considering they were keeping the entire country going through the war. So yes, the soundscape was whistling drafts and strange screensavers and the ventilation system and the engine. But the thing about the engine is, of course, it's a constant beat, like a heartbeat. It never stops. And if it does stop, everybody panics. And it happened twice. And immediately, you're out of your bunk. And one seafarer said to me, I love the sound of the engine. If it stops, you know, we're in peril.
Why is that? Just explain.
Because the engine runs all the systems of the ship, and in fact the whole miracle of seafaring comes down to the one thing, which is the propeller shaft. That just has to keep turning, and almost everything relies upon it. So if it stops, obviously there's trouble, and they go side onto the sea very quickly.
So we were talking about the parent company being very open, come in, come on a voyage. How open were various crew members to the questions that you wanted to find out the answers to?
It varied. They didn't understand what I was doing, and so I wrote a blog, which I had no way of posting because we weren't connected to the internet most of the time, and I put it in the lift so they could see what it was that I was up to. And then they said, oh, you're going to tell our story. And so then some of them came up and talked and talked, and others avoided me like the plague, particularly one young man who'd had his laptop seized by customs in Felixstowe. And I still don't know what was on that laptop, but he avoided me for 2 months. He was called Roy. I became very fond of him. But in the end, I was avoiding him so he wouldn't have to avoid me. And the whole thing became a sort of dance around the ship.
I wonder whether we might get a microphone and see if anybody's got any questions from the audience. If you have, stick up your hand either now or during our conversation, and we'll get a microphone to you. I'm interested in the relationship between the ship and the people on land, the pilots that come along and take you in and out of particular ports, the stevedores, the priests, and so on. What's the relationship like?
That's interesting. So the pilots, a dodgy pilot is a captain's nightmare because, of course, the captain is responsible for the ship. If anything goes wrong, it's him and his life out of the window. But a pilot technically ought to know what he's doing when they come aboard. So the captain has to look you up and down and decide, can I trust this man with my livelihood? And it only doesn't take place in, I think it's in Suez and on the Panama Canal, where in theory the pilots are entirely responsible for the ship. But in no captain will ever take his eye off the ball. So I watched one tremendous fight between the pilot and the Chinese the captain and a Chinese pilot, which my captain won, but it was like watching a sort of ninja battle between a sort of stance howling bear and screaming tiger. And in that one, Denmark won 1-0 against China. But with stevedores, they come aboard, they carry their own food, they want nothing to do with anybody. And of course, we think it's all automated, but it's not. You can only lash the first two layers of containers, or the first three, with lashing rods. And these are really heavy, long steel rods. And they have to, every single one of them has to be tightened into place and then released. And the containers locked together with locking pins, they have to be unlocked by a man with an enormous fishing rod with a hook on the end. And so it's intensely physical business. And if cranes are working over the ship as well, it's intensely dangerous. So there are ITF, International Transport Federation, rules to stop this happening, but they're routinely ignored. So as we went up the St. Lawrence River in the dawn, freezing, amazing dawn, through the ice, the entire crew, except for the captain and the bosun, were out unlocking and hooking so that when we arrived, they could start work in Montreal immediately, unloading the ship. All that was illegal, and it was illegal when we got there that there were men still there unhooking as the cranes worked. But the law and the sea don't really match up. I mean, there is no law of the sea, really. There are conventions of the sea.
Blind eye. There was a question just here.
Horatio. Hello, Paul. Hello, Horatio. Congratulations on this book, which I think is some of your best writing ever. A quick question. You speak very lucidly and emotionally about the relationship between the men and the vessel that they're on when you're on the voyage. It's almost like a spiritual experience, almost like a transcendental experience in parts of your writing. Was it always a relief to get to the port of destination, or was there sometimes the sense that you wished it could have gone on longer?
That's a very kind question. So the interesting about the sea is what it does to time. And the sea can just take time and eat it. A day can last forever, but a month will go like that. And seafarers are trapped because they want to get to the next port, and they want to get to the next port, and they want to get to the next one so they can get off the thing and go home and see their families. But at the same time, it is the real time of your life that's passing. So I would watch the captain, for example, striding up and down the deck, and he was doing his exercises, and he did them every night in order to reclaim a little bit of life back on land. But in terms of the relationship between yourself and the port, when you get there, I was looking forward, and we'd all talked about what we were going to do when we got to Los Angeles, having been 2 months at sea and 2 weeks crossing the Pacific, which was extraordinary. And I said to the Danes, what are we doing? And a Dane said, we're all going to Hooters. And Hooters is a chicken restaurant where the waitresses wear tight tops. And so I said to the Filipinos, what are we doing? And they said, oh, we're all going to Walmart. And we're going to go effectively and buy back some of the stuff we've just carried. And then we'll transition through airports. And the Filipinos are legendary for their airport transitions. It's a television under one arm and a chainsaw in the other hand. And they do it beautifully. So it was a strange, disappointing thing. And when we got to Montreal, it was the same thing. I was so looking forward to a beer. We talked about it the whole way. And I went into a bar and I had a beer. And of course, it's a crashing disappointment. And I felt like the Ancient Mariner. And I just wanted to grab them and say, listen, we've just carried this stuff here for you. There's a ship out there tonight. She stinks. She's good for razor blades and nothing else. They're still keeping her going. They're being paid Ron all. And they're extraordinary men. And so this is kind of why I wrote the book.
There's a certain sadness when you leave your first voyage, but it's not sentimentality, is it? I mean, you know that you're never going to be with these people again, on this ship again, in this time again, but there's something that just allows you to walk away.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I was glad to get off, I suppose, because I knew I had an amazing story to tell, but I miss it. And Maersk offered me 3 voyages, and the book only needed 2. And so I've got this notional third voyage that I keep in the back of my head. But
where would it be?
Oh, I would take the route of the Maersk Luz. I'd want to go from Australia. I'd want to do 2 months at sea full time and see what that is like. Because although ports are fascinating and the world seen from a container port looks like a stage set that we've just dressed from the contents of containers, what would be really extraordinary would be to get as close to the old experience. Because of course, the difference between the Filipinos and Melville's whalers was that the most junior member of those whaling voyages had a share in the cargo. Not one of the crew on any of my ships had a share in the profits of Maersk.
Do you still look up on the internet where those 2 ships are?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, sometimes I do. Yeah.
So you're still there in
They're
your
still
mind.
Going, which is surprising that they think the older one, Pembroke, is on her way out, but she's still there.
And I wonder, finally, it'd be wonderful to know, what have you learned about yourself from going on this journey?
So I learned that I'm a spotted and inconstant man, really. And I would love to have been a merchant seaman. When I was very young, I used to look up the ranks of the merchant navy and imagine which ones I'd have on my arm. But what they taught me was about self-discipline and strength. And there was an aphorism that the captain used. So when you're in the eastern seas and you're heading towards the fishing fleets, your first impression is a dark, dark sea and then a horizon which is covered in fire. And as you get closer and closer, all that ring of fire resolves into individual fishing boats. And on each fishing boat, of course, there's a crew of soft-bodied, wriggly little human beings, all of whom have families. And you must imagine that you're only 24 and you're new as a second mate and you're sitting on top of 115,000 tons, which will take 20 minutes to change direction effectively. And it's on you. It's on you. And my captain said it's very, very frightening for them. And I watched them in a hot, cool, air-conditioned cabin, sweating white with fear as they moved in. But the captain said, I teach them to bring the radar in close and not try and see everything all at once and let the fishing boats come to you. And I think I learned that that was part of a less worried life.
Wonderful. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't commend this book to you highly enough. It's available over at the Stanford signings side of things. Ladies, if you want to know what a world would be like with just men when we're not around, buy it. Men, I think, buy it, as well as for the stories, because it may well offer you a different perspective on manhood, I think. So really, it's a wonderful book. Horatio Clare, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's so kind of you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for putting up with that. Thank you.